This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 170 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we?
I'm good, David. We have a guest. We have an exciting topic this episode.
We sent out a clarion call for someone to talk about precision agriculture, and one of our listeners volunteered.
Our guest this episode is Brett Chilcott. Now, Brett founded Ag Eagle Aerial Systems in 2013 is a spinoff of a Kansas State University research project. Ag Eagle provides data acquisition drones for precision agriculture. They're an FAA Section 333 exemption holder, and their drone technology captures aerial images of crop health. Brett, welcome to the UAV Digest.
It's great to be here.
Now, before you founded your company, I understand that you had some sales and marketing positions with Cessna Aircraft and Cobalt Boats. And before that, I guess you led the development and engineering for Snap-on for a good while.
I was actually a sales and marketing at Snap-on and the product development at Cobalt Boats, yes.
Ah, okay. Well, good. I'm glad we've got that straight. So you're a manned aviation pilot before you became an unmanned enthusiast, I guess. And in fact, you've got a rather interesting airplane that you fly regularly.
My wife and I have a 1947 Stinson 108-2. It's a old classic airplane. We love to fly around the country or fly around the area.
Beautiful. We've actually got a photograph of the plane. We'll put that in the show notes just because it's such a great aircraft. It looks like it's a lot of fun to fly.
It's David's vintage aircraft that everybody says that they don't understand why I like vintage aircraft. Well, look at this Stinson and you'll know why.
You'll know why. All right. Well, we're here to talk about unmanned aircraft, of course. So, David, do you think we are ready to get started?
Let's get going.
Brett, let's start out and kind of define this term that we throw around kind of regularly on the UAV Digest, and that's precision agriculture. Now, of course, a good portion of our audience knows exactly what that means, but I think for many people listening, it's a term that they've heard and may not know exactly what it is. So why don't we start out with you kind of helping us understand what is precision agriculture?
Well, precision agriculture started about 30 years ago with the advent of the GPS and auto steering. So it basically started with tractors that would steer themselves and would steer a straight line down the field. And it's evolved today from just steering the tractor to the tractors and planters and chemical applicators being able to put the seed or the chemical within a fraction of an inch of where it's intended to be. And the result for the farmer and grower is better yields and a better performance out of his field and ultimately lower cost.
So how do drones kind of enter this space? What value do they provide for growers, let's say, when it comes to precision agriculture?
Well, there's a number of ways that the drones can help the growers, as it can be used as just a simple crop inspection tool to identify where the crop's doing well or where it's doing weak. But the highest return on investment for these growers is being able to not only identify where the plants are healthy and weak, but being able to convert that into a digital aerial map that the tractors understand. And for example, the chemical sprayers that apply chemicals or nutrients to the plants, they have the ability, these are the tractors that have the 120-foot long boom. They have individual nozzles, and with the advent of the GPS and computers, these nozzles now have the ability to apply the nutrients only where it's needed. So these farmers pay $200,000 to $300,000 for these tractors. But the problem that our company solves is the ability to create an aerial map that these tractors can understand, and hence that the nozzles or the sprayer will only apply the nutrients where it's needed. But more importantly, it skips the areas where it's not needed and optimize the nutrients.
That's fascinating. This is some high-tech kind of stuff. This is not like farming in the old days, and I can see how with the capital expense of this kind of equipment, you want to operate it efficiently and effectively. Do growers these days generally have an appreciation for the role that drones might play in this area, or is it sort of a hard sell that you have to make to the growers?
It's still new for a lot of farmers. They've heard about it. They've seen images on their farm magazines, but it's still an educational process to understand the value and the tremendous return on investment the drones have.
Now, when we talk about these drones and we talk about the kinds of farms where they may have application, these are large farms generally, I would assume. And that would require drones that can stay flying for an extended period of time. Am I right? In other words, this seems like it's more the realm of the fixed-wing drone than the quadcopter or multi-rotor.
Yeah, being from Kansas, our fields are very large here, and they're even larger out in the western part of the state. For example, some of our customers farm as little as 5,000 acres to as much as over 40,000 acres.
That's a lot of land. I know what an acre is to mow because I grew up mowing one, but 40,000 times that is a big farm.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So, and also in areas like Kansas and Illinois, in the spring, you also have some pretty robust winds blowing. And that's incidentally when this technology can be the biggest help. So you have to have a system that flies well in winds and flies a lot of acres. So the fixed-wing drone that we have with the model name is the RX-60, it will fly for approximately an hour. And during that hour, it can cover 200 to 300 acres per flight. So it's a lot of acres, can cover it rapidly, and more importantly, the data can be wirelessly sent to the sprayer as well after it's been analyzed by the agronomist.
And I assume this is an autonomous flight?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So the drone will take off by itself, and it'll fly back and forth over the field, capturing images, and then it lands exactly where you told it to, and that's controlled by an Android tablet.
So you mentioned the images. What kinds of sensors are we talking about for this sort of application?
There's a lot of different sensors we could use. We opt to use a more simple, a robust near-infrared sensor called an NIR. It's measuring the amount of reflected infrared light off of the leaves of the plants. So the way if a plant is healthy, it reflects most all infrared light. But when it's under stress or dying, it begins to absorb that infrared light. So our sensors can detect the difference between healthy and weak plants that way.
Can it tell you the reasons for the weakness? So, for example, I'm imagining one problem might be lack of sufficient water. Another might be pests or something like that.
Overwater.
Or overwater, sure. Are you able to differentiate that?
Not yet. So the systems like we manufacture today are, it is a tool. It's going to show the farmer or agronomist where the problem is, not necessarily what the problem is. So at this stage of the technology, it still takes somebody that understands plants and understands what the problem will be. This tells them where to look, and they have to make the decision of what to do about it.
So do the growers, I'm just curious, do the growers have that ability themselves, or do they look to other experts to do that kind of interpretation?
Now, most larger farmers do have that ability themselves, but there is an individuals that are called agronomists, which is basically a fancy word for a crop consultant, someone who helps multiple farmers optimize the growth of the plants. So that is one group that uses systems like the Ag Eagle, and they then advise the grower of where the problems are at, and then they pull these images into a farm management software, kind of like the Microsoft of the farm world. There's some tools out there called SST or SMS, and they would pull these near-infrared images into the farm management software and slice and dice the image to create a prescription map. And what's really cool about the technology today is after they create that prescription map, they can click a button on their computer connected to the internet, and it's wirelessly sent to these tractors while they're in the fields. So the tractor literally just has to lower the booms and click a button and pull up that prescription map, and the material then is applied per that prescription.
Wow, fascinating. Now, do large farmers, growers, do they want to develop their own skills with flying the drones and that, or are they more interested in purchasing a service, let's say, that where you or a specialist comes in and provides that service to the grower?
So far, it's about half and half. Half of the customers use it themselves, and the other half are the folks at the co-op or the agronomist that's doing it for multiple people.
And those that want to do it themselves, are they just sort of, you know, techie kinds of people, or why do they feel like they want to, you know, develop or devote the energy, the time to learn that?
You're right. Most of these farmers are the techie type. We have a farmer in Northwest Kansas that acquired a system several years ago, and he has a PhD in remote imagery. He studied under some professors, even with satellite imagery. And I asked him, what's the big deal? What are you going to do with yours? And shockingly, I learned that he was going to use it to manage weeds. And in that part of the world, they get such little rainfall that he wanted to use the technology to make the critical decision to either leave the weeds or spray the weeds to kill them off. Because the decision is, if he leaves the weeds, it will waste a lot of nutrients as well as moisture in the ground.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about how you came to be interested and involved in this. It came out of a research project, did it?
Yeah. So just jumping back to the beginning of my career, I grew up on a farm in southeast Kansas. And the joke on the farm was I would never amount to anything because I blew every penny that I ever earned on the farm on model airplanes and flying lessons. My family said, you'll never amount to anything. You're always spending your money on stuff that flies. So I've been fascinated with this over the years. But yes, a few years ago, my corporate job, I was asked to leave because the economy was not in the best shape. And so I was looking for something to do, and we started a composite business here in Neodesha, Kansas, and we were building parts for truck industries, and we got a small contract to build some micro wind turbine blades for a backpackable wind turbine for soldiers in the field. That led us to some advanced composites, the same processes that are being used for manned airplanes today. About that same time, I learned that our friends at K-State was doing some research, basically using model airplanes at the time. This is about 4 years ago, to acquire images of the field. And at that time, I knew nothing about it. And I collaborated with them to learn about it. And we've volunteered to make a small airplane. And at that time, I felt like I was Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, and somebody was rolling this scroll out and told me, here's a new industry that's about to blast off. I recognized that early on, and we basically pivoted our whole company and totally focused on the precision ag at that time.
Interesting. Tell us a little bit about the regulatory environment. As obviously we've talked about for, well, many months and years, it's been kind of a challenge to commercial applications. Now we see some progress with Part 107 and so forth. But can you give us an idea of what the regulatory landscape looks like from the farmer's point of view?
Well, oddly enough, from the farmer's point of view, legally, if he's using a drone to, even on his own field, to make decisions on his field, it's being used commercially. And technically, he needs his Part 107 license or certificate. And so most of our customers are earning those certificates. It does clear the air. Before the rules were clarified, people were real hesitant to move forward because they would they were fearful of buying a system and then not being able to use it legally. But now that they know what the rules are, a lot of them are taking the test and moving forward. So it's going to help long term.
Brett, are the farmers and everyone being receptive to the 107? They don't feel like they're having to go get something additional. I mean, they feel that it's a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, I think they feel that it's worthwhile because it adds some validity to the use of it, especially those folks that are agronomists or employees of co-ops. That it puts a sense of a qualification that if you can pass the Part 107, you're probably going to be a safe operator.
Let's talk a little bit of hardware. You mentioned the RX-60. The fixed-wing drone. Is this an aircraft that you designed and developed, or is it a modification of something else? What can you tell us about that vehicle?
Yeah, so it actually did start early on as a repurposed a hobby wing when we did our initial research and development. However, we realized early on that the hobby wings were not capable of holding the weight that we needed to, the payloads that we needed to fly, nor were they rugged enough. So over about a 2 week period, I studied the German flying wings during World War II and did a hybrid approach of the modern military flying wings. And yes, I designed the airfoil and the wing and the manufacturing process. Manufacturing process, it's made much like a surfboard or a water ski. It's carbon fiber infusion process made with vacuum presses. It's very, very rugged. Our customers are landing many times a day in a corn stubble, in a gravel road, and it has to be hold up to these rough environments.
What about the propulsion system?
So the propulsion system is an electric motor. It's a pusher type, and it's all electric. We use two 5,400 milliamp batteries.
Hmm. And what kind of flight times are you achieving?
Oh, we're about an hour. It depends on the wind. Of course, if you have a strong wind, sometimes that will cut down the time, but definitely about an hour, just under an hour.
And how much of the weight is batteries?
Most of it.
Yeah. It's like your laptop, right? You have a big laptop. You think there's a lot of electronics in there, but mostly what's in there is batteries. Same with your smartphone. Everything's mostly
right.
Batteries these days.
Yeah. That's right. Another thing about the wing is we have a pitot tube, just like a manned airplane. And because we're monitoring airspeed and ground speed, it will fly in about any conditions. People ask me, how much wind can the Ag Eagle flying wing fly in? And I said, well, I'm not sure. I've never found a limit. The most wind that we've flown in is we had to do flight testing before a shipment went to Australia. And the day before the shipment left, the winds in Kansas were blowing 42 miles an hour. And my crew here at the our little manufacturing shop said, you're not going to go fly in those conditions, are you? I said, we've got to do it. We got to get this shipment out. And they flew just fine. Hmm.
And what kind of ground station are you using? Is it since it's stemming from a radio control, is it a more simplistic thing? Or what's the ground setup look like?
Yeah, the ground setup is designed to be very simple. It's uses an Android tablet. And we have a radio dongle that plugs into the USB port of the tablet, and that communicates directly to the drone.
Wow, simple. That's nice.
Yeah. So the user pulls up a map. It looks much like Google Earth, and he just literally clicks around the field that he wants to survey, and the tablet will then create the flight plan, and he tells the tablet which direction the wind is blowing from. So the flight plan is crossways to the wind. So the aircraft is always flying crosswind. It starts downwind and it makes all turns into the wind. And you tell it what altitude you want to fly, and it adjusts the flight paths accordingly. And everything is automatic, adjusts the controlling the camera. And there's several readouts on the tablet itself. It tells you what your flight time is, what your battery conditions are, and how many photographs you've taken, and all the critical information.
Do you have any geofencing in it yet? How often do this vehicle violate? You know, here I live in Philadelphia. If I turn on my Be Safe Fly FAA app, it screams at me and says, you got to be kidding. What kind of safety considerations have you put into it?
So there's a automatic safety to return home if it loses communications after a certain time frame. There is no geofencing in it as of yet. You got to understand the areas that we're flying from. Typically, we are miles away from communities, and we're out in the middle of nowhere, and just trying to keep it as simple and user-friendly as possible.
Sure. Brett, when you look into the future, if you polish up your crystal ball, how do you see this industry changing with respect to agriculture?
I believe it's going to be rare in the not-too-distant future for an agronomist or a crop scientist or a farmer not to have some type of drone at his disposal. It'll be rare that they don't. In the future, I see a longer range once we all have a better understanding of what the FAA needs for beyond line of sight. There'll be systems developed that'll be flying multiple fields rather than just one or two fields at a time. We'll be flying multiple fields. And that data will be processed more rapidly, providing more instant feedback. Our system is designed to be connected to the cellular system as an option. And those images will be streamed down to the ground in real time.
Is this something that's happening worldwide, or do you see this concentrated in the United States or certain other countries?
We see it worldwide.
Yeah,
we
ship, I would think so.
We ship systems literally all over the world, many to Australia and Chile and Argentina. But it's taken off in other parts of the world as well.
Hmm. Well, one thing that we certainly see a lot of these days are conferences, drone shows, things like that. And again, all over the world, there are lots of these events. It seems like practically one a month. And I guess, have you participated in any of those?
Oh, yeah. We've been to quite a few shows. Most recently, we were at the Commercial UAV drone show in Vegas. I guess that was just this past week.
Yes.
But yeah, it was a nice show. One of the things that I'm surprised at as I go to these shows, it appears that we call them WYSIWYGIDGETS. There's a lot of cool WYSIWYGIDGETS, and at the end of the day, they're new technology looking for problems to solve, versus identifying a problem and designing a system to solve that problem. But there's some fascinating tools coming out, some small radars coming out, smaller LIDARs. This technology, this industry changing rapidly.
It sure is. Yeah, miniaturization is still occurring, I think. We've seen a number of ADS-B kinds of equipment coming out in very small form factor. Along the lines of keeping the unmanned aircraft separated from the manned aircraft, I guess in an agricultural application like this, it's probably not too much of a big problem just because of the location. Is that a fair assessment?
That's correct, but the user still needs to keep an eye on the system and watch out for low flying aircraft. The biggest threats would be a aerial applicator or crop duster, as it's been called, or a pipeline patrol. So the new crop dusters that have the turbine engines, they can sneak up on you, although they try to be above 400 feet, 400 to 500 feet, when they're flying from one field to the other or faring from one field to the other. Sometimes they don't, and we've got to be on our toe to avoid them.
Hmm. Interesting.
Brett, speaking of shows, we talked about you going to a UAV-centric show. How about agriculture shows? Are you starting to see drones pop up there as really a agriculture utensil instead of drones that do agriculture? Understand my question?
Absolutely. Yeah, we actually attend more ag shows or farm shows than we do UAV shows anymore. The show in Las Vegas was a bit unusual at this stage of the game because, to your point, there frankly were not many farmers or growers there, but I was surprised at the number that were there.
Well, Brett, this has been really fascinating. I think we've learned a lot about applying drones in the precision agriculture arena. Tell our listeners where we can learn more about Ag Eagle or any other resources online that you might suggest.
Sure. Our website has a lot of information. It's ageagle.com, ageagle.com. We also have a Facebook page. It has a lot of viewers and a lot of information on there. And then we also have a YouTube channel on how to operate and how to make sense of the data. And that's where the industry needs to be focused as far as the use of the data. You know, I jokingly tell folks that if you could train a pigeon to take a camera up and do what you need to do, you don't care how the images are captured, but you want good quality images that can help you increase the yield of your field. And at the end of the day, that's all our customers want. Yes, there's been a few customers that have buy systems like ours because it's cool. But frankly, at the end of the day, technology becomes more productive when it gets boring. And so we're at that stage where people are saying, okay, I bought this. How can I make it pay for itself? So that's what it's all about, the return on investment and the use of this technology in precision tractors that can apply the chemicals where it's needed is the highest return on investment.
And Brett, how does it feel to be such an integral part of a newly emerging industry, something that's undergoing all this change and something that offers all these opportunities? It must help get you up in the morning.
Get me up in the morning or keep me awake all night, one or the other. But yeah, it's, you know, it's almost a full-time job at this point, staying ahead of technology. Learning about the new sensors and what the customers want, but or need, But yeah, it's exciting to be on the forefront. We were one of the first companies in the world doing this. And, you know, most technologies today or new industries begin in somebody's basement.
Yes.
Or somebody's garage, and this was no different. I built our first systems in the basement. So I applaud people that have the stick-to-itiveness of making something new and jumping in the industry to make something happen.
As you grow, are you able to find people that have the kinds of backgrounds and the kinds of talents that you need to expand the company?
Yeah, we have 9 employees at this point, and it has been somewhat of a challenge to find people technically competent as we need. However, we've been very fortunate. You know, we're in a town of 2,500 people. We have one stop and go light in our little community here. But coincidentally, I was at our local high school. And my daughter and a friend's daughter was having a banquet, and I sat down next to a gentleman I'd never met before, and come to find out he had built drones, multicopters, 8 years ago when he had to build his own autopilot to inspect wind turbines. Huh. And so we struck up a conversation, and he's now our chief engineer. So we're very blessed to find folks like that.
All right, very good. Well, Brett, we want to thank you for coming on the show, helping us understand this this area more. I think I know I've learned a lot. David, did you learn a lot as well?
I did, and I appreciate him volunteering to come on the show. It just proves that we have a really good network out there of listeners that want to participate and share what they know. So anybody else, feel free to reach out to Max and I. But Brett, we definitely appreciate it. And if you ever get to Pennsylvania in the Stinson, let me know, because I could really I would love to go for a ride.
Well, I'd love to take you for a ride. In fact, I'll be flying to Wichita tomorrow. And David, Max, I appreciate what you're doing for the industry. This is very helpful. And while I'm working here in the office or tinkering on my Stinson in the evening, I listen to your shows, and it's done a lot to help me.
Oh, thank you so much. All right. Well, I think with that, we'll wrap this one up. I want to thank all of you for listening. This has been episode 170 of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's theuavdigest.com/170.
And of course, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UAV Digest. You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. And if you'd like to participate and help the show, you can leave us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or Google Play. You can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. And of course, you can become a patron of the show at patreon.com. And all of those links are available on our show notes. So I guess with that, I will say, this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.